Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we have some very interesting things to discuss with you on today's podcast. In just a few moments, we're going to discuss with you why your experience in the womb may actually determine whether you ultimately end up obese or with bad eating habits. Also, we're going to take a look at the big controversy surrounding 23andMe. That's a place where you can send a DNA sample, usually based on a cheek scraping or a sample of saliva, and you can find out a whole lot about your biological fate, your genetic endowment. And it turns out that the folks at 23andMe are in the middle of a firestorm of controversy. We're going to take a look at that in just a few moments. But before we do that, let's talk about something that also has been subject to controversy lately, e-cigarettes. E-cigarettes, if you've seen these devices, I'm starting to see these appear on New York City streets. People are walking around with these cylindrical tubes in their mouth, and they're puffing and inhaling, and usually these things have a blue light, a blue LED light on the end. So instead of a hot red ash, they burn, so to speak, with an electronic blue light, and they literally dispense nicotine into your lungs, which is a very efficient way of delivering nicotine into your bloodstream and throughout your body, and particularly to your brain. Where nicotine addicts apparently have a susceptibility to its beneficial effects. Nicotine lights up the brain. There's no question. It is highly addictive. And many people have proposed e-cigarettes as a preferable alternative to ordinary cigarettes, and for good reason, because when you get an e-cigarette, all you're inhaling is the nicotine. A little more on that later, because that may not be all you're inhaling, but at least theoretically, you're inhaling nicotine. The nicotine is provided in a little cartridge. It is dispensed in a way that is thought to be similar to what you get when you drag on a cigarette. And oh, by the way, have you noticed it's getting harder and harder to smoke in most places in the United States, particularly in New York City? It's virtually impossible to smoke. You can't even smoke outside anymore. You can't smoke in a public park. So an acceptable way to get your nicotine fix is to get one of these e-cigarettes. And they're not very expensive, but they're kind of like Pez dispensers. If you're old enough to remember what those were, there were little dispensers that dispensed a little candy that you'd pop into your mouth. And the Pez dispensers weren't very expensive, but the refills were, and that's how the manufacturer made their money. That's a good business model for making a lot of dough. And part of the problem, too, is that there's now enacting new laws that make it even more prohibitive to get cigarettes, lots of taxes, and also now a new law in New York City. Some people say that's totally unenforceable, raising the smoking age to 21. However, it may easily be possible for kids 21 and much younger to get e-cigarettes. So is that okay for kids? I mean, look, you're eliminating the tars and the burning vegetable material, which is thought to mostly be responsible for lung disease and cancer and heart disease and all the ravages of cigarette smoking. It's actually kind of controversial as to whether nicotine itself is bad for you. There's some people who chew nicotine gum or take nicotine lozenges after they stop smoking for many, many years and decades or for the rest of their lives. And it's unclear whether they're causing themselves grievous harm. Nicotine is addictive. It does have a tendency to constrict the blood vessels. But actually, some studies show that nicotine maybe in some ways a beneficial substance. It's been shown that nicotine may slow the progression of certain neurological diseases. That might make sense because nicotine has an effect on the brain. It may light up certain centers of the brain that are associated with movement, such as in Parkinson's disease, which is a movement disorder. It may forestall the deterioration of those parts of the brain or provide kind of hamburger helper to declining levels of neurotransmitters as you age. So the nicotine itself, it's a controversial substance. Some say that it's got very bad effects. Some say the effects are neutral. Some say it may even have some beneficial effects. Probably the truth lies somewhere in between. But there's no question that it is highly addictive. Some studies have compared nicotine to heroin in terms of its addictive capacity. Anybody who's an ex-smoker, you know what pangs of withdrawal you go through when you stop smoking. So clearly it's very addictive. And part of the criticism of these e-cigarettes is that it's considered sort of a gateway drug for kids. Kids are now utilizing these e-cigarettes and are smoking them either in the open or surreptitiously. It's very much in vogue. And they're inhaling nicotine, which gets them hooked on cigarettes. So the question is, ultimately, will they go for the real thing once they're hooked on the nicotine from the e-cigarettes? It's unclear whether they will resist the allure of real cigarettes, and that's part of the concern. I mean, it's kind of just like taking one step further than when we were kids, they used to give us little chocolate cigarettes, and they came in realistic packets, you know, Lucky Strike or Pall Mall or Winston. And so we would have these little, we would stick these little chocolate cigarettes in our mouth. And maybe, just maybe, that was something that was condoned by the tobacco industry because, a 6-year-old or a 10-year-old, not going to be able to smoke a cigarette, but yes, they'll be able to puff on a chocolate cigarette. And that may create some degree of acceptance for adopting a smoking habit later. All right. Well, that is not what the focus of this particular feature is on. Because you can debate the social policy implications of providing e-cigarettes to minors forever. The concern of this particular clinical focus is that a new danger has been pointed out from electronic cigarettes, and it was published in an obscure scientific journal called PLOS-1. People in the general public have never heard of it, but scientists and people in the medical community often read and quote articles from PLOS-1. A new study in PLOS-1 has uncovered a concerning fact about electronic cigarettes. Toxic metal and silicate particles. What are silicate particles? Well, silica is a component of glass. And in fact, the way that you, in ancient times, they used to make glass is they just would take sand and they would heat it and melt it and turn it into glass. So when you heat silica particles, in effect, you might be inhaling molten glass. But worse yet, toxic metal particles may be present in both the cigarette fluid, that's in the cartridge that provides the nicotine, and the heated aerosol. These may be in the form of what are called nanoparticles. Nanoparticles are a big concern because they're very, very tiny particles. You can't even see them with the naked eye. But these tiny particles may easily be absorbed by delicate tissue. In other words, a tissue in the mouth, in the throat, or in particular in the lungs. They may actually even have the ability to get into the bloodstream because they are so tiny. And so if you're inhaling hot molten metal particles or hot molten glass particles, how good that can that be for you? It says in this article that researchers at the Department of Cell Biology and Neuroscience at the University of California, Riverside, are testing these e-cigarettes. And they did all kinds of scientific analysis. They used light and electron microscopes. They tested cells in a test tube to see if these tiny particles had a harmful effect on these cells. And what they found, and they actually show a picture of this. It's very interesting. If you take apart an e-cigarette is not like a regular cigarette. It is actually a little bit of an electronic device. And as such, it's got internal metal parts. And these metal parts are soldered together with ordinary solder. There's probably some factories in China or wherever the heck these things are mass-produced where industrial workers slave using magnifiers and tiny solder guns to put these things together. And the filament that they use to heat the aerosol is a nickel-chromium wire, and it is soldered to a thicker copper wire that is coated with silver. Now, the problem is that sometimes, apparently, this solder at high temperatures can melt and has the potential to be inhaled. So the aerosol, when they tested it, turned out to contain particles comprised of tin, silver, iron, nickel, aluminum, and silicate, that would be molten glass, and also nanoparticles, even greater concern, because like larger particles, you know, maybe the body can handle that a little better, but nanoparticles, very, very tiny, of tin, chromium, and nickel. The concentrations of 9 of the 11 elements were higher than or equal to standard concentrations in conventional cigarette smoke. And many of these elements are well known to cause respiratory distress and disease. So the authors conclude, and I'm quoting, the presence of metal and silicate particles in these cartridges and atomizers demonstrates the need for improved quality control in electronic cigarette design and for studies on how the electronic cigarette aerosol impacts the health of users and bystanders. Unfortunately, they're calling for studies that may take decades to complete. You know, what's going to be the fate of somebody who puffs on an electronic cigarette, 10, 20, or 30 times a day, inhaling molten metal or molten glass deep into their lungs over a long period of time? It may end up being just like with regular cigarettes. It took us a long time to recognize the problems because smokers don't get sick, the first 6 months or even 5 or 10 years that they smoke. But the cumulative effects can cause cellular changes that lead to inflammation, emphysema, chronic sinusitis, cardiovascular disease, and ultimately cancers. The bigger concern is that there's something kind of weird about these tiny metal particles. And this is pointed out by Sire G in a very interesting website. You can go to it, greenmedinfo.com. They have very nice articles there, greenmedinfo.com. We tend to think of, what causes reproductive cancers? Well, plastics, estrogen, right? These are generally big molecules. But it turns out that new research suggests, and this is from a journal called Cancer Research, that certain elements, metal elements, increase the risk of postmenopausal breast cancer because they represent an emerging class of, here's a new word of the day for you, metalloestrogens, metals that have the effect of amplifying the body's response to natural estrogens which are present. So this has the potential to add to the estrogenic burden of the human breast. For example, excess dietary cadmium increases the risk of postmenopausal breast cancer. Who would have thought that, the ones that seem to mimic estrogens include aluminum, antimony, arsenic, barium, cadmium, chromium, cobalt, copper, lead, mercury, nickel, selenite, tin, and vanadium. This is a concern. It's even a concern for certain types of poorly made vitamins that contain the wrong forms of inorganic metals that are, usually cheaper vitamins may contain lower quality forms of these essential elements. And whether they're taken in orally or whether they're inhaled, they may pose problems. So I think we got to take a long, hard look at these electronic cigarettes because they're all the rage. Our kids are using them. There are more and more regulations about smoking, but you can use electronic cigarettes with impunity because they don't bother other people or create secondhand smoke. But they may pose unacceptable hazards to kids and adults who now believe that they are a safer alternative to cigarettes. All right, this next one's about genetic testing. And one of the most popular self-testing services is something called 23andMe. The reason they call it 23andMe is that you have 23 pairs of chromosomes for a total of 46, and that is the way in which your DNA or your genetic coding is organized in your body. And we're making major strides in understanding the relationship between our genes and our DNA coding and risk factors for various diseases. And so for $99, you can get, that is until recently, a kit from this company. And I think it's based on a cheek scraping or a saliva sample. And you can find out a whole lot of information about various things. Number one, you can find out about your ancestry. And this is just a source of great fascination, especially to baby boomers these days. You know, perhaps they're searching for some sort of identity. They want to know about, you know, where they came from. What is their origin? So lots of people are going to genealogy websites, and they're going back and reconstructing the family tree. And with 23andMe, you can find out, my ancestors came from wherever. Belong to this race or that race, or I'm an admixture, and that seems to be a source of fascination for a lot of people. Also, you can find out if you have what are called SNPs. SNPs are, that is short for single nucleotide polymorphism. Yeah, it's a lot easier to say SNP. And what that means is that at various sites of genetic coding, you can have variations. And some of these variations predispose to disease. Now, this science is progressing very rapidly, but it is, to some extent, in its infancy. There is a new proposed field of study called nutrigenomics. It has the word nutri, like nutrition, and genomics, which sounds like genetics. And the idea being that based on our genetic makeup, we can determine what diet might be best for us. This is also based on ancestry to some extent, because if your ancestors came from equatorial Africa, they may not be highly suited to consuming lots and lots of salmon, for example. But if your ancestors came from Greenland or Northern Europe, they might require higher levels of omega-3 fatty acids. Similarly with grains, it is thought, or fruits and vegetables, higher carbohydrate diets might be better suited for people from a more lush tropical part of the world. People who come from the frozen wasteland of the north, they might have had less opportunity to raise plant food during a diminished growing season, and thus more reliant on animal food. It would be cool if we could do genetic testing to say, oh, you're a Nordic type, you're an equatorial type, you know, whatever. But so far, that's a little half-baked because our genetic coding is very, very complex. But you can find out, based on 23andMe, whether you have a predisposition to cardiovascular disease, to diabetes, to obesity, to osteoporosis, and many other conditions. Homocysteine, for example, is an example of a genetic coding variation. People who have high homocysteine may be more prone to vascular disease and blood clots. And however, the problem is, the big problem, is there's a difference between genes and fate. Genes do not absolutely determine our fate because there is something called epigenetics. Epigenetics describes a process by which your actions and your environment shape your genetic potential. A good example is the Southwest United States Native Americans, who until the advent of civilization were lean and absolutely free of diabetes. But with the advent of Western lifestyle and especially Western food, they have a virtually 90% rate of type 2 diabetes. So clearly they had the genetic potential, so-called thrifty genes, that were great during periods of deprivation and near starvation in desert subsistence conditions. But when plenty of food arrived and fast food and especially with food assistance programs that subsidize lots and lots of cheap carbohydrates, candy, and of course with the advent of soft drinks and alcohol and more sedentary lifestyle, these people have become diabetic. But this is epigenetic modification. It also can be shown that you can reverse diabetes perfectly well in these same individuals when we encourage them, and there are programs to this effect, to revert back to a more paleo type of lifestyle. So there's a lot of controversy about these tests, and the attacks are coming from two directions. One is that the government has issued a cease and desist against the manufacturers of 23andMe, and they're powerful folks. This is a Google-backed company, and it's a little concerning because a company that has links to Google that is harvesting your genetic information, you know, talk about privacy concerns, and yes, it's supposed to, all this information is supposed to be confidential and firewalled. Google is a vast data mining operation, and just from the standpoint of the information that falls into the hands of these big supercomputer giants, there may be some concerns. But that's not what this is about. What the FDA is saying, you're making claims that are too outrageous here. These are medical claims, and we're going to stop you from making these ambitious medical claims. In addition to determining whether you might be prone to disease, there's also another interesting ramification of these tests. They actually can predict whether you are a brisk responder or a not so brisk responder to certain drugs. So some people metabolize drugs very quickly; they're out of their system very easily. Other people just require a little bit, and that's why you see a great deal of variation among people responding to medications. So that's a very useful tool for doctors and for people involved in self-care, because then they can realize, I'm not going to, take a lot of Tylenol because I have very slow detoxification. Or they may discover that aspirin thins their blood very quickly. There are a whole host of drugs that work through various metabolic pathways that can actually be assessed through a test like 23andMe. Well, the government says, hold on here. You're making too many promises to people about this. This sounds very suspiciously medical, and we're going to have to work with you to negotiate out some framework in which you can offer these results, probably with a lot of disclaimers and maybe a watered-down version of the test. What is of interest is that I live in the only state in the United States which absolutely prohibits genetic testing, 100%, and that is New York State. They're very, very down on genetic testing, probably for the same reason that FDA wants to restrict it, because they say, well, this is like a medical thing, and people shouldn't get this information because it might freak them out. I mean, there are elements of this test that show whether you have a higher predisposition to Alzheimer's disease, whether you have a higher predisposition to breast cancer. That's a big deal. And that could get people to, A, freak out psychologically, B, seek radical medical intervention, like, trying to scope out a bilateral prophylactic mastectomy, like Angelina Jolie. And so they're saying the public cannot be entrusted with this information. For my part, I got to say, I'm mixed on this. FDA, I think, has a point. But in general, I really hate the way that FDA interferes with the public's access to supplements of our choice, to tests of our choice. I think that information is good, and that the information should be appropriately interpreted. It'd be nice to get a health professional involved in this. That, I think, is useful because, a layperson with that information, perhaps somebody who's a little bit hypochondriacal or cyberchondriacal, might look up all kinds of things on the internet and become completely perplexed by the results of a 23andMe report. So I like to sit with patients who come from out of state who had this test done and try and sit and interpret the test and encourage them to look at it not as their genetic absolute fate, but to look at the possibility that epigenetic modification can reduce their risk of expression of their susceptibilities. It's not a doomsday process. But here's the interesting part. In the wake of the FDA warning, okay, this is civil and administrative. So they got to tangle with the government in, a government, agency, wrangle, right? That's number one. Now, new headline. It's just from this week. Federal regulatory concerns about 23andMe have spawned a class action complaint against the Google-backed genetic test maker. So here come the lawyers. They want a civil action, and they want to extract civil damages from 23andMe. And predictably, this comes from the state of California. California is famous for class action suits. It's one of the easiest places to launch a class action suit that usually doesn't go to court, but settles for a great deal of money, most of which ends up in the hands of the attorneys. And, if you have several, 100 or several thousand people involved in a class action suit, they might each get, $11.32. But the lawyers might get hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars when the case settles, as it often does. The complaint is filed by a single plaintiff, a female San Diego resident who purchased a $99 kit in September and submitted a DNA sample. It is alleged by the lawyers that the defendant, that is 23andMe, has marketed and sold the kit to consumers for years without any analytical or clinical data to support the device's efficacy. So they're going to say that this is a half-baked test, and it is a menace to society. And now they've got the U.S. Food and Drug Administration basically on their side, because they've issued a warning letter to 23andMe already. And the attorney representing the plaintiff said the FDA's warning was a big help. Thank you, FDA, for doing some work for us. Mark Ankhorn, a litigator at, check out the name of this law firm, Casey, Jerry, Schenck, Francavilla, Blatt, and Penfield, LLP, in San Diego, said this: when the news broke, that really changed things significantly. Ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. And now 23andMe is going to have to lawyer up, both on the FDA side and now in civil court in California, to defend their test. And I got to say that, it's a shame that this is the way that, we've got to regulate these things. I think that tests like 23andMe have great promise. The results need to be taken with a grain of salt. They need to be interpreted very carefully. But I think that on the plus side, these tests, if they don't produce too much fear, and unnecessary consternation can provide a useful guide to people in terms of what they need to look out for. I think it requires a lot of sophistication to understand and interpret these tests, and that's why I think probably these tests should be marketed via physicians. And, oh, by the way, a lot of work needs to be done in terms of the accuracy and predictability of these genetic prognoses, because by no means is it a sure thing that a certain genetic variation that might be picked up on a spit test is going to determine your ultimate fate, whether it comes to a disease or longevity or anything else. So it'll be very interesting to see how this pans out. Meanwhile, 23andMe, it's going to have to shut down while this whole thing gets sorted out. Okay, this next one is interesting for prospective moms or for parents of small children, because it turns out that bad eating habits start not just early in life, but they may start in the womb. So moms-to-be, be careful what you eat. And also, when you're raising an infant, be very careful what you feed that infant, because it is of huge consequence, ultimately, in terms of that baby's food preferences and their potential for obesity. This according to an article in the New York Times by Kristen Wartman, entitled Bad Eating Habits Start in the Womb. The solution to one of America's most vexing problems, our soaring rates of obesity and diet-related diseases, may have its roots in early childhood and even in utero. Wow. Researchers at a place called the Monell Chemical Senses Center, that's an amazing research organization down in Philadelphia, they have found that babies born to mothers who eat a diverse and varied diet while pregnant and breastfeeding are more open to a wide range of flavors. So you're eating really for two, not just when you're pregnant, but also while you're breastfeeding, because you may impart flavor preferences that carry forward into childhood and adulthood. And that's a big deal. According to one of the researchers who's quoted in this article, Julie Manella, biopsychologist at the Monell Center, what's really interesting about children is the preference they form during the first years of life actually predicts what they'll eat later. So, for example, another of the researchers at the Monell Center says infants exposed to a variety of flavors in infancy are more willing to accept a variety of flavors, including flavors that are associated with various vegetables and so forth, that might lead to a more healthy eating style later on. Have you ever noticed, you know, if you're a parent or grandparent, that kids, if you give kids like stuff that you might yourself find repugnant, like baby food, you know, like peas, broccoli, stuff that's, yeah, kind of grody, you know, if you serve that, you know, on your dinner banquet plate, you'd say, oh man, that's hardcore stuff. That kids accept that up until a certain age. Then they get finicky. So there's a critical period, and it seems to be that period around up until about 3 to 6 months. And that's a time when you can really shape a child's food preference for life. The concern is that dietary patterns track from early to later childhood, but once they're formed, once kids get older, it's really difficult to change. And so we want to expose kids to healthier food early on. There's evidence from animal experimentation in rodents that exposure to maternal junk food results in little mice or rats that prefer these same foods. They even have found that there is a kind of a reward pathway, an addictive reward pathway that requires higher levels of sugar and fat to trigger if you're used to it. So the brain of these babies can actually be shaped by the types of foods that are given while mom is pregnant. Mothers who are fed foods like Fruit Loops, Cheetos, and Nutella during pregnancy had offspring that showed increased expression of the gene for an opioid receptor, which resulted in a desensitization to sweet and fatty foods. In other words, if you're not less sensitive to sweet and fatty foods, it takes more to make you feel satiety and satisfaction. So, it's like we're seeing more and more kids who need these really sugary, spicy, gastronomic fireworks to get them excited about food. And the result is that something like an ordinary plate of broccoli, not too exciting, a highly processed, artificially flavored food is going to light up their brains, so to speak. Literally, they can image the brains of people who have this blunting of sensitivity to ordinary flavors. So obviously, in this article, they say the research calls into question the ethics of marketing poor quality foods to children as well as the marketing of infant formula because, food manufacturers take advantage of this programming because if you get kids early in life, you can capture not just a short-term market, but you can capture a lifetime market and reap decades of annuities from the junk food that the kid is going to consume. And also, not only is there a physical conditioning of the brain, there's also an emotional conditioning that occurs in kids. They tend to associate certain foods with comfort. And if your comfort food is carrots and peas, that's one thing. But if your comfort food is, Coca-Cola and Gatorade and highly sweetened cakes and pies, ringdings and so on, that may become a lifetime dependency. You know, when you're subject to emotional stress, as occurs later in life, what are you going to turn to? But the things that you were imprinted with as a baby or even more mechanically in utero. So this article is by Kristen Wortman, who is a journalist. She's currently writing a book on how the industrial food system is changing our minds, bodies, and culture. And we anxiously await that book. And hopefully, once it's out, we can invite her as a guest here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast and interview her. She says, we hope to reverse the tide of obesity and diet-related disease in America, regulating processed food products and infant formula and creating clear warning labels to deter parents from feeding their children potentially harmful foods may be our best shot. Let's make sure future generations have the best chance to become healthy adults. And, you know, yes, regulation, in my opinion, is one pathway, but education trumps regulation all the time, in my opinion, because regulation, well, you know, the ultimate experiment in regulation was prohibition. And look what happened then. Human nature is such that they try to circumvent the rules. And by providing you with information, such as via these podcasts, hopefully this will enable you and your family to make better food choices. Well, that's it for today's edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we'll be back with more Intelligent Medicine available from our website at drhoffman.com. You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce, and so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via our convenient internet portal or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the intelligent medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or, alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening, and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.